It's awesome to be here. It's the first time I'm here. It's very impressive. I would like we have something like this in Vancouver. That would be beautiful. Triumph has basically no office space, and it seems like you have a lot of office space. We should do that. So I'm here today, also tomorrow. I'm currently mostly in Atlas for the last 10 years. I do long-lived particle searches. I do a lot, actually, really trying to boost that quite significantly, if you're keen to talk about that. I worked with Gambit for many years, always a very low flame, but I initially implemented, together with Pat Scott, the whole neutrino likelihoods into Gambit, and then sort of do a bit of the collider side of there. That's more or less what I participate a bit. And then in recent years, let's say 3 years, I'm kind of moving towards the neutrinos again. And so I want to tell you a bit why this is a real cool chance so far. Yep.
For a second, do you want to move the mic a bit?
I think. Okay, I think it's hidden. Here we go.
Yeah.
Why not?
I think the sound probably is not great.
Let's do that one. How's that?
Yeah,
better? Okay, let's do that. Okay, so what is P1? I don't know how many of you have heard of it. So let's start with the vision. So I was told I shouldn't do a talk to basically to tell you how awesome it is, but I still have to tell you a bit what the idea is. So then we are at the same page, and then we'll take it from there. So this is our current vision. Don't take this for granted, the layout. It's really under study. The thing is, people know of neutrino telescopes, these high-energy neutrino telescopes, quite well how to build them in principle. So it's not the first time we try to do something like that. So the design is quite inspired by, of course, IceCube. So actually, almost everybody in P1 is a former IceCube person. Some very few bits in Canada now who came from dark matter physics or so, but basically everybody else is a former or current even IceCube person. KM3Net has really developed this kind of multi-PMT sensors. Of course, we want to take that. So this is our current kind of vision. I will talk way more about this. Has really significant design features we're going to do. The clustered approach, what GVD, that's the Russian experiment in Baikal, is doing, let's take this with a grain of salt. We're not sure. We'll see what is optimal. It might not turn out to be the best way to do it clustered. Maybe you want to have it coherent again. So you can ask the question, what's different and why we want to do this different and why at all. The first one is all of these technologies are actually quite old. IceCube is 20 plus years. KM3Net has taken a very long time because they had significant issues to deploy it in the Mediterranean. So it's actually also quite old technology. I would say 10 years plus. And GVD is actually very similar to IceCube technology. It's also single PMT, so it's a very old technology. Things have moved on significantly since then, and I'll come back to that. Also, in terms of KM3Net, they have quite some issues deploying, so they had setbacks. They're now, I think, it's moving quite well. But it's obviously quite challenging in water to do that. So this is exactly what we want to tackle and what I'm going to come back to. And this is also the second part of this. Why P1 here in Canada is because nobody tried to do that actually in collaboration with the people who know how to deploy things in the ocean. And we have something, it's called Ocean Networks Canada. I don't know if you heard of that. But it's a huge research infrastructure, which is actually something in the east as well, but most is in the west, outside of Vancouver Island. So I'll come back to that. So that's the reason why this even was born to do that here. So then I can ask the question, why do we actually need another neutrino telescope? So I'll try to motivate this a bit. So most of the motivation, and that is, of course, you will have like kind of a laundry list of the awesomeness what IceCube has achieved in the last, I would say, actually since I left. I left in 2013, so I made the first discovery. So I think it's coincident that I left and then, exactly, yeah. So then, since then, they really are on a high, on a roll. But it's mostly about, I would say now, I think they've done a fantastic job as well in the lower energies, but the thing which is going forward is neutrino astronomy at the moment. And just as a reminder, why the neutrino is the perfect messenger, it is electrically neutral, it's basically massless, you essentially can't absorb it, and it also tracks nuclear processes, which is very important, makes it so interesting, what we can look for. So in this case, for example, you don't get any radiation effect with photons, you're actually quite guaranteed what you get, what you see you're going to get. But of course, they're very difficult to detect, as we know. One slide, I think you are all aware of, that's why I want to keep this very short. How do we even operate this so that we're all on the same page? So this is actually a beautiful animation from IceCube. So this is the full IceCube detector. So each of these are these strings, 1 kilometer strings, and the little dots, you might see them. They're the optical modules which are implemented on IceCube. So the neutrino comes in. Of course, we can't detect the neutrino itself. It undergoes an interaction, can be charged current, neutral current, then depends on the topology what we get. Here it would be a muon. The muon travels in IceCube up to kilometers because the energies are so high through the ice. It emits Cherenkov light. And because we are a transparent medium, that's why water or ice are fantastic for that, because it is transparent. We detect this Cherenkov light. We try to detect it exactly when the photons arrive and the amount of the photons. And from this, you can reconstruct the lepton. And then from the lepton, you can infer back at these very high energies quite precisely the properties of the neutrino. So direction is very easy. Well, very easy, let's say easy. And then energy is, of course, generally depends how much is contained, either in a lower bound, or in case of a electron, then you actually have kind of a shower, more blob-like event, and everything is contained. We obviously, which I don't going to talk so much about, we have different topologies. The muons are the easiest, so they are the tracks, very long tracks. Then you have electrons, which essentially give you a kind of a contained shower. I will mention tau neutrinos. They can give you significant sort of double bang structure. Actually, in a picture, this would all look like one blob, but in the timing of the photons, you can kind of see a double bang. I will come back to that. And then, of course, all the neutral current interaction will give you generally a kind of a blob-like topology, not a track. The tracks clearly have the best pointing, but it's amazing what you can pull out of the timing of the photons, of the arrival of the on these PMTs, in terms of the pointing also for the cascades. It's really fascinating what you can pull out, and I will show you a plot, of course. Okay, here's a little animation. The size of the blob on each of them is kind of the amount of the photons, and then otherwise the color is the timing, and you can see beautiful the kind of picture and the idea of how you can then reconstruct this trajectory, and from there go back to the neutrino. So neutrino telescopes are simple, big but simple. So to put the kind of what we look for, this is kind of one of these plots of the neutrinos in the universe where you can get the huge energy scale. Obviously, the very low part is what maybe some people wish or dream of to ever detect in terms of neutrinos, and trying to push for example, these CMB neutrinos in the moment. Here is, of course, what has been so successful, man-made in terms of reactors or also accelerators, as well as, of course, what we studied in the sun and so on. So these are the MeV range of neutrinos, which has been enormously successful, also in Canada. And then if we overlay a little bit what we can actually detect for the neutrino telescopes, we go really to the high energies. So maybe you can push that down a tiny bit here, but this is the observable window with respect of something like IceCube, what we can do. It's, of course, a shame to some degree, but also very interesting, because we cannot, in the moment, man-made accelerators don't enter in this kind of high energies. So we can reach 50 GeV, or maybe we can do a little bit more in the future, but of course we cannot reach these energies. But the universe brings us these neutrinos at these extremely high energies. And I think there is also, not only for astronomy, for particle physics, I will come back to this at the very end, which kind of is more where I came from initially, and I'm still very interested in this, a huge potential to study neutrino physics at literally PV scale. But you need the right detectors for this, and also very, very large detectors. The one thing which helps us in general, which is different to other, if I work on ATLAS, the neutrino cross-section is kind of beautiful because it rises. So it helps us a little bit to fight this extremely steep falling flux of very rare high-energy neutrino events. And it really comes up. And then also here, we'll come back to that one. The electron neutrino cross-section has this on-shell resonance here with a W boson. Which actually IceCube has most likely seen one of the events. So you can really produce one on-shell W in the so-called glass shell resonance. By the way, you can always interrupt me if you have questions. I think it's, I'm totally happy with that, whenever you want. So let me give you a few of the, as I said, really, really remarkable points why I think this field is so interesting right now already, really emerging. But also at the same time, I think in neutrinos, which I kind of do have to say, is the best or the most inspiring discoveries in the last few decades, and the most surprising ones as well. So I think there's a huge potential also going forward here. So since 2013, so this was the last thing I kind of participated in, and then it really took off when I left, it's probably not the nicest plot, but I like it in the sense. So it's very scattered here. It doesn't look like much. So IceCube has much more beautiful plots. So we look at really the high energy tail. So this is the energy of the neutrino in GeV already. So you would see the expectation of the atmospheric background. They actually took that up. They subtracted it here. And they really only show the astrophysical component, what they have measured. The reason why I like this plot, it's not only combined together, it actually shows different topologies. So IceCube has really seen since 2013 now, not only in the first, let's say, muon events or in cascade-like events, they have seen really in all of the topologies, also going upwards, going horizontal, going downwards, they have seen an excess over the atmospheric expectation of this astrophysical flux of neutrinos. This is just historical. This was really the first one, which was quite remarkable. I don't know, maybe you remember this or you have heard of this, but generally what the principle of neutrino telescopes is always that you take the Earth as a shield from background, and the working principle is you see everything that comes from the other side up. That is the golden channel, or thought to be previously the golden channel to discover any astrophysical neutrinos. Maybe you go quite a bit to the horizontal scale. Actually, what this first one was, which was discovered, is downgoing events. Because it turned out at very, very high energies, you can use a very efficient self-veto technique if you have a large detector. You literally just say a veto, which is very thin on the outside, which vetoes everything at high energies because you're really high energy muons. They come in bundles. You can very easily tag, so to speak, the muons which come in from atmospheric showers. And then you can decipher basically your astrophysical neutrinos extremely well in these downgoing events, because you have no activity within your veto zone. So you can, if they're at a certain high energy threshold, so really kind of in these energy ranges where we look at, you can extremely efficiently identify them. Also, you can reduce the background of atmospheric neutrinos, because at these high energies, the atmospheric neutrinos would always be accompanied by muons. It's kind of a bundle. It's a full shower which comes down. So if you actually see zero activity, you could be extremely certain, it's kind of an atmospheric self-veto, so to speak, that in the downgoing range, these events are really events which are of non-atmospheric nature. So very, maybe you heard that story, but that was the first channel where IceCube discovered it. And then only afterwards, the more traditional means of astrophysical neutrinos, how to discover the flux, came back.
Why don't the astrophysical neutrinos have the shower? I mean, the cross-sections seem to be the higher energy. So why don't the astrophysical neutrinos come with a shower of stuff?
Because it's only the neutrino which comes. So it's the neutrino which is generated.
I see. So the
wherever you want. Exactly. The atmospheric comes with the proton, the cosmic ray interacts, has a whole slur of muons, neutrinos, everything comes.
It's just a cosmic.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you can have those events too where the neutrino interacts outside and then the products kind of leak in.
I don't know
if they're very good for, right?
You mean if a neutrino would interact outside here, or
then you
would not be able to distinguish that. Then it's vetoed as well. So these are really, so the sensitivity to the flux is literally how large your volume is for these kind of detectors.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Is the e to the minus 2.4, is that power law consistent through the different data sets?
Kind of. I think the plot is a bit, so this is, I think, 2 years old. I think it has, so the different data sets still now, I would need to go back. I'm not an IceCube person right now. I need to go back. It is not incompatible with the uncertainties, but whether you go for cascade topology, which would be electrons and tauons and neutral current and track-like events, they're not quite the same.
Do you know how large the tension is?
I don't know right now. I can look it up, or we can look afterwards. But it's not too bad, because the precision is lacking, as you can still see here. But it is right. They're not exactly the same power law. it's not fully consistent. All right, then the next thing, of course, the one, maybe that's really for the astronomers, is you want to have this typical multi-messenger picture. And that came in, I think the event was recorded in 2017, the announcement was in 2018. So this is from a blazar, literally staring down the gun barrel of this jet, as you can see here. Also as a reminder why this is so interesting in terms of basically how we create these neutrinos at these sources is exactly the same what we do at a lab today. If you go to Triumph or anywhere else, gonna go to Fermilab, the way, the mechanism of how the neutrinos are produced in cosmic accelerators versus what we do on Earth is exactly the same. We just can't accelerate protons to the energies what a black hole can do. But we accelerate protons, or by now we know this is happening, before we did not know this. You can accelerate protons in the magnetic fields. They will go into some interstellar medium or just around whatever the object is you have. And you have your pion production, charged pion, neutral pion production. So if you have protons in here or hadronic acceleration, you will get an equal amount of kind of flux in terms of photons to neutrinos created at the source. Of course, photons you could also create in synchrotron radiation many other ways. So that never tells you really if you have hadronic acceleration in these kind of sources. But the mechanism is really the same. But of course, that gives you exactly this multi-messenger picture, which people, especially in astronomy, are extremely excited about. And this is, for this event, IceCube detected a very, very high energy neutrino, exactly at a flaring state of one of these blazars. And Fermi and also other cosmic gamma ray telescopes and also Earth-bound telescopes detected essentially a high flaring state. So this is kind of the underlying pattern here. These are the counts at very high energy gamma rays. And then you can see the one neutrino event, which was extremely high energy from the source exactly during that flaring state. This is kind of redefined. It's not two events, it's one event. One was the initial, and then they reconstructed it with offline techniques better, which is lying here close to the source. So also it's quite remarkable that one very, very high energy neutrino event is already almost 5 sigma if it comes in coincident with a very short flaring state. Because you're in energy so far above the atmospheric background, and you're also in this time coincident window. So even one neutrino event is already extremely significant. But it was one neutrino event. They actually looked back into the record of the 10 years, and they found that this source did over the record of the 10 years also together with the flaring state, which of course is recorded by Fermi and other experiments, that they also emitted neutrinos. So this is a whole story about this.
So what were they saying earlier? So the previous ones, they weren't detecting time because?
Because they're more in low energy. They were not quite as striking. And this was a quite unusual flaring state. The techniques of all these optical follow-up, super high energy neutrino event, basically sends out an alert by now to all the telescopes, look, is there something special? This is implemented for a while, but now it's really, it's a perfect implementation of a network by now. And it was a quite spectacular event by itself.
I thought people were disputing whether this was the blazar. I heard some...
So I don't know about that one. So what I do know, which I also personally find a little bit more unconvincing, is the record back into the 10 years of data. That is a bit less convincing how the state correlates together. So that one I would also agree from an outside perspective, but I have not heard that about the very high energy event. Okay, so the part which I want to come now is also the flavors. And by now, I think they're very certain. Here, I still have very likely. So here's one of these events. They found one exactly at 6.3 PeV. You would get this Glashow resonance event, which is really spectacular. Because the cross-section rises, has really a sharp peak in there. All the neutrinos which should come in there, you should actually see some more if the neutrinos have these kind of energies. So it's really spectacular. Almost whole of IceCube lights up with 6.3 PeV. I always can't resist to put that one in, because what is the saying? One person's signal is the other person's background. It's kind of really the story. Like, I think it's probably amongst the most unspectacular events you can have at the LHC in Atlas. So here would be a W boson created, decaying obviously to a lepton, in this case a muon and a neutrino. Within ATLAS, highly unspectacular. Generally, most people don't look for this unless you're one of the aficionados who tries to measure the W mass at the ultra high precision. But for everybody else, this is generally background, which we want to get rid of. But I had to put it in there. Okay, so then to complete the picture of the flavors, so IceCube also, again, with very high likelihood, I think is two tau neutrinos by now, potentially. Again, at very, very high energies. And here you can see what that would, so the cascade structure would look very similar within your detector. But if you look at the PMTs themselves, what is recorded, you get this typical double hump structure. In some more and some less, depending how they're facing. And this is exactly this double bang structure of essentially a tau neutrino then interacting again. So it's like twice a light pulse. And here you can see again the point, which I will come back to. The better your timing resolution, the better you could resolve this, the better, of course, capability you have to identify the flavor, in particular here for the tau neutrinos. What makes it very interesting, also from me as a particle physics more coming, is now you have the point muons anyways, but we have electron neutrinos, and of course now we get to the tau neutrinos, so you can do at the PeV scale or hundreds of TeV scale, you can start to push for actually looking for neutrino oscillations, what's happening there. So you will have sources which create these neutrinos. There are obviously also ideas at the source. If you just go to generic source production, as I said, cosmic rays or protons dump into the interstellar medium will give you a certain composition. They will oscillate, and you can really start to probe also in terms of the fraction what you see, neutrino oscillation at these energies. So that's something I think which is quite interesting, but of course very limiting in IceCube right now.
Where are the tau neutrinos and the electron neutrinos coming from in the source?
Like, they would not.
They will not.
No. Right? So it's a muon source creation. Exactly. At high energies,
so this triangle is only the oscillations. And
exactly. So you do have, for example, here the red dot, the triangle. So you would start at the source creation. I think it's a 1 to 2 to 0. So no taus. Electrons you can get, of course, but they're usually not quite at high energy. And then you, after oscillation, you come exactly sort of into this band error, what you would expect from general source production. And if you go somewhere outside, then you would have abnormal, unusual oscillation, so to speak. But you can see, I mean, what is the 95% confidence interval? It's like almost the whole triangle at the moment.
This is the latest?
I think so, yeah. Maybe they have an updated version, but right, it's just simply the statistics are missing. That's just what it is.
100% new E.
Exactly. But the point is, what I want to make is the opportunity which is there, if you have different opportunities, which we'll come to. Okay, so the last one of these, what I want to show is from last year, the second source.
Is there, I mean, this the oscillation angles are anyways measured on labs, so is there any possibility that these oscillation angles are somehow
So you don't measure angles here, you don't, so this is not the idea of atmospheric neutrino, I think you have in mind atmospheric neutrino oscillation and the...
Yeah, I mean, you measure all the PMNS angles on Earth, on labs, or like in atmospheric, etc., right? So what I'm trying to get at, is there a possibility that these will see something anomalous?
So here you could just come with the fraction, because they're so high energy at that point. This is the astrophysical flux. So you're not doing the kind of oscillation parameters, which would be, that's the low energy type of oscillation analysis, where you take the atmospheric flux, which you understand very well. And then depending on the oscillation length and also absorption through the Earth, you get kind of an oscillogram in energy and measured angle. So this is a bit different. This is really just the flavor. If you could just identify the flavor.
I understand. Okay. Like, can you measure angles better of the BMNS with these than with, say that you identify a source.
Yeah.
A very precise redshift. You know exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So you, and then will that give you a better measurement of a or of an oscillation angle that
So I think the energies are not right. Yeah, the energies are not right. I think the oscillation effects you would get always much better. I mean, you will never reach these statistics. This is a
oscillation is also a bit of a misnomer for this.
Yeah,
these are all decoherent states. What you're really seeing is just the projection of, let's say, whatever start point that you have in terms of the flavor.
Yeah,
and you just project that onto the mass basis.
Yeah, that depends on angles and something,
but
right?
You're not going to get a good measurement of the oscillation parameters of this.
No.
Okay.
What you can do is, if you look at that triangle, the dotted, correct me if I'm wrong, but the dotted region is what the current oscillation data allows you
exactly
to be.
I see.
And then if you fall outside anywhere, and you could this with enough statistics, and you measure something around here, then you know you have probably additional states or unusual interaction.
Okay, so
new physics,
from oscillation data.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's either new physics or you identify the type of source. So if you get an infinitely small ellipse around the square, orange square, for example, then you know that's the source of all neutrinos. That's the flavor composition of the source.
Exactly.
But if your ellipse is only around the butterfly region there, that's the dotted region,
it's not enough.
Then you don't know what the flavor composition of the sources are, and you're not doing better than oscillations. You're just, it's compatible with...
If you measure an extremely small circle around the square, then you say it's the flavor of the source, but then that will mean that the source is creating, say, taus or neutrino taus or something like that, which will be really weird.
No. That's the flavor on the at the Earth.
Yes, that's the flavor of the Earth. So what? Yeah, what does it
mean? Have taus because the mass.
Exactly. So for example, the red dot would start up here.
I think like if you, I think what Daniel was saying is like if you just get the orange like in the middle, like and you say like it's orange, then like it will be able to tell you what the source will be.
So this is a certain hypothesis here. They would all start somewhere. Yeah. For example, the red dot here. This would start at 1 to 2 to 0, somewhere around here. Yeah. And then of the distance in terms of oscillation, this is the expectation what you would get at Earth. So this would be at source creation, very standard, which gives you kind of a democratic neutrino states at Earth.
Infinitely small ellipse around the square, orange square, you're saying the source is
exactly
0. But at the Earth, it looks like you have tau components.
Exactly.
It's only because you project it onto the mass states.
Yes. Okay. We can come back to that. I'm already taking like probably 3 times as long as I wanted on this.
No,
so
it's very early, so we
can't. Yeah, no, we can come back to that. It's a good point.
Okay.
All right, so the last one I want to show is there's a second source, which was, I think, was it November, October last year? Here you can see a typical kind of sky map of potential sources. And what they identified, again, is here this NGC source. You can see quite nicely now. This is the background expectation, the signal on top. It's a very nice, I think, result. Not quite 5 sigma, but it is very, very convincing that they found a second source, which is a very different type of source. I will show you this in a second. But it also shows you how many events. So basically, they have signal events in there. These are almost 80 neutrinos which are needed. And that is, of course, in parts because of the angular resolution. So if you could push that down, significantly fewer signal neutrinos would help you already to identify more sources. And this is, by the way, if you followed this at all, massive amount of effort, really impressive how much they improved their reconstruction and understanding of IceCube. Like this is now already including the full slur of graph neural networks, everything you want to put there. It's like this is, we are at the stage where LHC squeezed out of the performance. This is where IceCube is at right now. So I think that is important. It's not any first effort anymore. Really amazing, impressive. It was actually a very nice announcement, to be honest, also for an experimentalist to see. Okay.
So compared to the other galaxies, is that galaxy like unusual?
I'll come to it in a second. Yeah. So I think just to show this as well, to wrap this up, to actually get to P1 at some point, what Ice Cube really, I think, convincingly has shown neutrino astronomy is real. You really can identify them. Also, what is extremely interesting, this plot is always a bit hard to read, but you see the three messengers, the cosmic rays up here, the photons, and now the neutrinos. The picture, of course, in the neutrinos is very error-prone in terms of error bars, which is exactly the point where we want to improve on. But if you look at this, and this is the energy density or the amount of energy the universe really sends to us per second. And it is quite remarkable that in all of the messengers, the amount is roughly the same, what reaches us, because it's here corrected in terms of density. So that's really, you can see, you can really do neutrino astronomy and try, if you could identify these neutrinos more reliably, and also the flavors of them, you could do real physics and also, of course, astrophysics with them. So here's kind of, I want to skip through that, but you can see the timeline from Ice Cube, from completion. It's very slow. It's single events. It's a real discovery machine, but it's just skimming it. It's very clear, which is great. Luckily, it made it exactly to that threshold, but it's just skimming it. So how can we understand the picture just of the astrophysical part? This is exactly the question what you just had. So the discrepancy between the diffuse flux, what Ice Cube has seen, which is the top here, and the two identified sources is immense. So these, the flux from these two sources is roughly 1 or 2% of the astrophysical flux. So it's really kind of a bit awkward. So you would expect to see significantly more sources by now. There's a bit of a reason for Ice Cube, because the pointing is not so great. So you need to kind of, in order to identify sources, you need to have very good pointing. But you see, like, of the flux we see, only 1 or 2% of them can be kind of attributed to the two sources which were identified. The two sources also don't match at all. So this is the, I mean, the one event, or now it's not only one event, because I told you they go back in time a bit and have a bit of a better measurement of this Texas source. It's very distant. It's quite far. So, okay, it's kind of compatible with the idea that it's very far, very rare source, very high energy. That is kind of compatible. NGC instead is significantly closer. It's a quite close source, but also much lower in energy. So it should be a kind of maybe a more common source. So they should see significantly more of these. It's kind of a bit of an obscured source. So it's kind of an active galactic nuclei, which has a lot of dust around it. So it's kind of obscured. That's why also the photon counterpart is not seen very well. But it's for neutrino emission maybe great, because you really dump exactly these protons into interstellar medium. So maybe that's the reason why it's seen, but it's unclear. And then, of course, the last question is where the galactic source is. This is the closest, and we would expect neutrinos from the galactic plane. So I can't show it because I'm not an Ice Cube. You told me already that you know about it, so then I can also say it. But there is basically, I think it's four sigma or somewhere around. And Ice Cube is starting to show around that they have seen now also evidence, or strong evidence, for galactic emission or from the galactic plane. They cannot resolve sources, but they have seen now from the galactic plane also neutrinos, which is, of course, very, very interesting. Again, the question is, okay, in case of galactic emission, I wasn't quite sure what I can say. So it is, but now can we resolve sources? We want to resolve sources. And here I want to also show you some.
How much closer was the new one from the NGC compared to the?
I don't know in terms of redshift right now. I need to look it up, but it's significantly closer. It's like literally one of the close by galaxies. We can. I need to look it up. I really don't know. Sorry, but we can. So the first part now, where start to come with P1. Why it's interesting. The way to really detect these neutrinos, all most exciting neutrinos what Ice Cube has seen so far fall in terms of Ice Cube exactly into this green band, which is kind of the horizon and a little bit above or a little bit below the horizon. And it makes sense, because all these very high energy neutrinos, this is this plot, which is a bit complicated, but essentially the survival probability, the Earth becomes opaque for these high energy neutrinos. So you actually cannot look up for these neutrinos. They have to come horizontally, or with these self-veto techniques, they have to come from above, because the Earth really shields these high-energy neutrinos. So they don't survive. So everything interesting Ice Cube has seen is exactly in this kind of green band. So now when you put KM3 net, the the field of view, what K3Net has of, in our galactic coordinates is this. The nice thing is if you put basically P1 in there, we have integrated time. We have a fantastic field of view of our basically galactic center and the galactic plane. So this is overlaid here also with some Fermi sources from the source catalog. So if you want to actually really look for a very, very high and long efficient time in the most sensitive region of neutrino telescopes, P1 is at a perfect spot in terms of at the location of the Earth to really monitor for a very, very long time these galactic sources.
Sorry, so the dash is the galactic plane?
Yes.
And IceCube has seen the galaxy?
You can.
Green band.
For example, here, you can also do here, but you're just not, this is not the maximum of your sensitivity. So you have to do way more tricks, your effective area goes down.
How do you define the band?
So this is, the band is essentially, so in terms of, that's why IceCube is easy to understand, it's literally the horizon and a little bit above and below.
And
because it's located at the South Pole, that's why it's this straight band through the...
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So this one you probably know. This is just a picture of neutrino telescopes right now. So who is actually capable in the moment to discover anything at the TeV and PeV range? There's one, and that's IceCube. And that's why it's no wonder why we heard about that. Who is trying to do something similar? As I said, it's GVD, KM3Net, and then we are kind of the latest incarnation. I actually dropped China off here, who also is trying to push for something like that. So I always like this slide from Francis. So it's already 2021. He already concluded, we need more and better neutrinos. And this is exactly now the question. How do we get more neutrinos and better neutrinos? Because I hope I could convince you, probably you have seen most of these things, and we took twice as long as I wanted, but it's really exciting what's there. But it's not enough. The exciting science, particle physics, astroparticle physics, astrophysics, you cannot do with IceCube. It's not enough. It's a discovery machine. But if you want to do more, it's not enough. So you need more neutrinos and better neutrinos. So IceCube is trying this. They actually cannot really get better neutrinos. Better neutrinos in the sense of better energy resolution, better angular resolution, because they really squeezed out whatever is possible. They probably can do a bit more with the electronics. So you can go to newer technology, multi-PMT, better timing resolution. But the ice is simply the limiting factor. And I'll show in a second why. What they try to do is to get more neutrinos by going big. So you capture more of the same by going big. Another way what you can do is you can try around the same size, but try to be more precise. And this is, for example, to understand a bit the difference between the medium, ice and water. So this is if you have a PeV horizontal muon going through ice, like the medium as you have an ice cube. So you see a lot of photons. The photons live for a very long time. Absorption length is humongous. But scattering length is very short. So the photons, they survive a lot. It's almost like a perfect colorimeter. But the information of each photon is very obscured because they scatter. So you're never certain from where it came from. Whereas if you look in water, you see very, very little scattering because the scattering length is huge. But the absorption length, unfortunately, is also a little bit shorter. So you see less photons. But if you see the photons, they are originally emitted from your charged lepton, can be detected by you without much scattering in between. And this is the photons which give you the precision in the end.
Why does that happen? I mean, ice is less dense.
It's always a good question. And we actually had a huge discussion recently in a PhD defense about this. And because it's not obvious,
Yeah, it's not obvious at all.
Exactly. But let's just, maybe in interest of time, we can come back to it, I also don't have a really fantastic reason which I can give you, but it's a fact that, so I think it's also, so in ice, of course, we have also ices. This is not pure ice. You have a lot of dust ingrained, but that's generally more the absorption, not the scattering. The scattering comes really... Good question. Yeah? I honestly don't have the answer. No, it's something which comes up all the time, you know?
It might be something to do with density fluctuations.
Yeah, maybe. But there is actually a paper, because we looked this up. If you have perfectly pure ice, it's not so different. But
I think maybe like the clouds. Why are clouds not transparent? Like, there's a lot of scatter because,
yeah.
Anyway, we can discuss it.
You can.
Probably because,
yeah.
So
you have impurities, it could be,
you
well.
You have impurities in,
yeah,
the structure if you have, that's why ice is not transparent,
yeah,
while light is. So I think maybe that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, but it's a very good point. Eh? But generally, experimental audience just buys it. Eh? So okay, so maybe here is the one slide before I try to tell you how awesome we are building at the moment, which tried to convince you why the idea of water is not so bad. Here's this kind of simplistic Euclidean universe approximation, how much more sources you can detect above a certain flux, you know, if you have better sensitivity. As I said, IceCube tries to build something which is around 5 times larger. So that gives you around 10 times more sensitivity in sources. Yeah? Currently, the idea of P1 is to do something of a similar size than IceCube, but significantly more precise in terms of the pointing resolution, which again, also is the other way you can go to give you around 10 times more sources. And here you can see sort of just preliminary if we take what we have. So here would be an IceCube effective area. Yeah? So as I said, the light yield at the low energies is not so good because of the absorption. But if you go to high energies, of course, this doesn't matter so much. And let's say doesn't matter, comparable size of IceCube. Yeah? That's the goal at the moment for P1. The key is if you look at the angular resolution for the two types you want to identify. So tracks is at the top. So this is the current significantly squeezed out as much as they can do, IceCube angular resolution, the median angular resolution here in terms of muon energy in TeV. So it's up here. So if you go to the trigger level of P1, so that you don't make any selection yet on the quality of these tracks, how much is actually inside your detector volume, you're already significantly better. And if you would make assumptions very similar to what IceCube essentially ends up with in this to get to this curve, you can see the pointing resolution is at the 0.1 degree here at 1 TeV. Yeah? So this pointing will tell you, of course, instead of have 80 neutrinos to point back to NGC, for example, you would need significantly less because you have really good pointing. And that is the medium, the quality, plus also the newer technology, of course. For cascades, is another thing. So cascades, as I said, this is actually very impressive. It doesn't look so impressive, but it's impressive that IceCube at all has a pointing capability of cascade-like events, purely by the timing of how the shower develops. So if you would go to this time over threshold readout, it's included in here because this is what KM3Net has. So they just have for each PMT a time over threshold. It's enormous how much you can literally almost go to a pointing which is almost as good as for track-like events with cascades. Yeah? And then if you, of course, we want to read out the full waveform in P1, you can push that down even more. So here already I want to emphasize is the flavor we want to get, yeah, so that you can really get the flavor of the neutrinos, but then also, of course, point with these. Yeah? So then you can do real physics with them, particle and astronomy with that. So that's the pitch case. Yeah?
The galaxy detection, do you know?
That would be here.
My impression, it was,
yes,
only cascades.
Exactly.
So
that would
be even more amazing.
So you can resolve, plus you have the location would be, of course, you would see the galaxy. Yeah. Also, it's not surprising. So Antares, I don't know how real that is. They have Antares is small, very small. I'll come back to that maybe at the very end. They heard about this from IceCube, so they looked frantically, and I think last year already put out a 2-point-something sigma, I don't know what it is, indication, that they see something from the galaxy. So Antares is tiny, but the pointing is already better in Antares than IceCube. So
this is the pre-KM3Net.
Exactly. Project. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to do this quite a bit faster because I don't know how much time you want to spend. But now I want to tell you a little bit about P1, at least what we have done so far, to make you that this is not a crazy vision only. We are actually hopefully on a good track. So the real thing about trying to do this in the ocean, it's very, very, very challenging. It's not easy at all. So I think Ice Cube is very challenging the location and do this, but the ocean is extremely difficult to do this. The environment is harsh. Deployment is like almost in space, it feels sometimes when you get the cost. And things break in this salt water. It's really not easy. So there's a good reason why KM3Net had actually quite a bit of a struggle. So that's why you want to partner with people who are really good at that. And I think Ocean Networks Canada is a real opportunity for this community. So where are we? This is where I usually sit. It's a huge, huge cabled network outside of Vancouver Island here. So, and maybe to show it here a bit more, so they, it's kind of a dream. So someone cabled this thing, and essentially you just have to build your detector, and then you can drop them in, and there is power source, there is internet down there, so you just plug it in. That's kind of the idea of this network. So these are these stations. Of course, they have their limitations, but we would not reach these limitations for now. The full-fledged P1 could not be supported right now by this. So that would be a hand-in-hand upgrade needed. But we can support quite a bit, probably around half of what we have envisioned in the moment for P1 with the existing network of ONC, in terms of power and data transfer and so on. Okay, so where are we? We are interested here in the Cascadia Basin. So very similar, these typical around 3 kilometer depth, similar to Ice Cube as well. It's an abyssal plain here, very low current overall, very stable. So it looks like a very good place to do. So I will tell you a bit that we actually identified that what we could do. So we had two Pathfinder missions in 2018 and 20 to explore if this is even possible. So the first one, we put down two short strings, 150 meters here, like 40 meters apart roughly, with some obviously kind of light emitters and also absorbers to understand the water properties of the ice. Also to see what can ONC even deploy something like this for us and everything. So it's like a real test concept. So here you can see some pictures. This is actually already the second Pathfinder mission, which looks significantly more Ice Cube-like already. These kind of structures was a bit longer string. And here you can see, for example, one of the ROVs when they attach down to the anchor, the strings here. So the first thing we found, which
what
is of course, yeah.
At the bottom of the ocean.
So they have, no, they have kind of, let's see, this is the painter if you do this. So they have certain anchors here where they can attach them. Some of them they have to drop first. For some they have, and especially in these instrumented sites, they actually have potential anchors to do that. So for P1, we would drop an anchor. You will see that in a second, how this would look like. The first important thing is, of course, it's not the LHC where you know exactly when the beam comes. You don't know, so you have to be always ready for everything. And that was not clear. So this is more of a test of ONC, I would say, than of our instruments. So they could deliver over this time where we tested here, almost 2 years, a bit more than 98% uptime, which is very, very important because you really don't want to miss anything. Ice Cube is better. They are 99 point somewhere. But I would say 98% is pretty good. So then we, of course, need to know is the optical properties good? I'll go about this a bit quicker. So we can, with our instruments, we can emit light flashes. We can absorb them, of course, the different absorption length. We don't have a measurement yet in the moment for absorption and scattering. We have this kind of combined attenuation length at the moment. But this attenuation length, when you compare this here with the sort of several measurements also from KM3Net, the different sites, Lake Baikal, there is one measurement. So we are not quite as clear here as the KM3Net site, but we are pretty good, close to this. Also, we measured very low, so you're very, very much more affected by kind of sediments, and the water is a little bit less clear. So if anything, we expect this to be closer to what also the KM3Net sites are. Yes?
How important is it the alignment of the detectors?
We'll come to that, yeah.
Oh,
okay. Very important. Also, this was all stable over the 2-3 years we measured, which is also very important. So it was always constant. It didn't change. So we didn't have a variability by season whatever you can get in the ocean. Okay, so the optical properties were great. One thing, I'm not going to talk here too much about this. So we also measured other things, the ambient backgrounds, and it is absolutely optically possible to do that. It's a good site to build a neutrino telescope here in the Cascadia Basin. The one thing which is enormous potential, maybe that's more of a funding ploy, but I'm actually really amazed by how much there is interest. We have workshops of days by now of people who want to use our infrastructure, if it ever exists, for interdisciplinary research. So that is marine biology, oceanography, even tracking whales. It turns out nobody in the ocean has an infrastructure of this size, of this extent. So this goes from acoustic. Of course, optically, we have single photon sensors, an array which instruments, let's say, in the end, cubic kilometer of the range. They can study literally how much the biomass migrates a kilometer up or down. Nobody has a clue in the Pacific how to do that, because they do not instrument anything of this size. Acoustically, they're super interested, which we will implement as well. But to basically ping from Hawaii acoustic signals to our detectors, you can study the ocean in between, depending on temperature variations. You can track with the acoustic pingers whales, so you can warn ships. It's amazing. People are super, super interested. Not exactly my cup of tea, but of course it's very, very interesting. And what the plan is right now, to have a interdisciplinary science data stream, which is directly available. You can literally download it directly, and they can do whatever they need to do. Whereas the physics science data will be a little bit more in the typical proprietary sense that we have it for a while before we try to maybe release something. Okay, so one thing I wanted to show you in that perspective, which is quite interesting. So what this is, a simulation. So bioluminescence is one of the pain. You saw a picture right now. So these, we have the lanternfish idea, but it's more the pyrosomes, which are kind of these organisms. If they don't emit light, but if they're disturbed, they will emit light. And of course, that's not necessarily the best you want to do if you want to detect single photons. So this is a simulation. This would be one optical module. If they're blue, they don't care. If they get red, they get agitated. And they get agitated when they're kind of in these turbulent streams, when they get close to an optical module. So this is a simulation. Here would have over time, and here would be different detectors if they would, for example, different photon wavelength, how much photons they would sort of emit over time. These are two different populations of organisms. So we did put a kind of instrument like this into the water in the second Pathfinder mission. So these are different wavelengths for small PMTs. This is actually the camera where you saw the picture before. And you can see in the different wavelength, we do exactly see some sort of pattern like this. And then you can, of course, between data and simulation, you can do your analysis. And they identified that there are two typical organisms or species which apparently emit light very differently. And it's just one toy, not toy, but small point how you can actually use this for marine biology, for example. But the potential is really huge. Nobody has these kind of things. And I also thought initially, OK, why? OK, well, CAM3NET does something like this already, so why is it special? Well, this is exactly the thing why it's really special, because nobody does in the Pacific. And for example, climate change, oceans change very differently here than they do in the Mediterranean. So that is science which is really interested here. So we can only do that in the Pacific. Things you have to understand for a while when you don't, it's not your expertise. OK, so what's the status? And then I'll wrap up with that. So we've done that. That was sort of the Pathfinder missions to really understand, can we do it? So now we are in this pilot phase. Pilot phase also equals trying to get money phase, maybe, but also to show that we can really do this, what we have planned. And so far, it's an extremely aggressive timeline, what we are trying. So if you, this is the instrument I showed you, which were kind of 110 meter length, where we measured the optical properties. The second one was longer. But let's say I think the scientific value was maybe less. We had some instruments, as I just showed you, for marine biology. And this is not the full. We have more PMTs on them. But now we go to the mooring line, which would be the typical kilometer scale. And this is also the image now of what we envision. And this is extremely innovative and very different. So we also need to minimize the risk what KM3Net has. So if you look at that, or if you've ever seen a picture of IceCube, there come external connectors into the glass everywhere, cables trying to connect readout. So this is a new concept, together developed with McArtney, which essentially has no external connector. So you have the cable, which is load-bearing and has data transfer, power, everything. It terminates inside here, this titanium flange. So you have nothing outside. And the glass spheres, the typical glass spheres, they're essentially sealed off here, and you have no outside connectors. So in principle, the risk is extremely mitigated or minimized that you have these typical failures, which is, for example, what KM3Net is fighting really a lot. All these external connectors in the ocean, which are very tricky in salt water. Has to be shown that it works better. But that's the concept in the moment. Of course, you can see also this kind of multi-PMT approach as typically. This is the calibration module, which I'll come to in a second. It's just one slide. So the prototype line we built, we really tried to deploy the first full-fledged line next year. Still possible. We'll see if we slip, but I think it's still fully possible right now. It's a huge endeavor. So you see here the first prototypes of what we, so one of the hemispheres with the PMTs, typical way. Here's just some electronics. But the point is really, everything has changed so much. The electronics, what are available, FPGAs, what are available, the memory you can get with these electronics by now, which means the data you can buffer, has so incredibly improved. So for example, if you take Hyper-K, which is also developed in parts at least at Triumph, the power consumption, what the Hyper-K mainboard compared to this one, we have more physics capability than the Hyper-K board. And we use, I think, a tenth of the power by now what the Hyper-K board has, simply because it's 5 years difference in terms of electrical engineering here and FPGA engineering and everything. So that is really the change, which is really driving this as well. You can really have time resolutions, which are amazing, and you can read out the full waveforms, which is the information you want in order to get to these curves I showed you before. Because otherwise, you have to go the IceCube way and build huge. You want to make the neutrinos, as Francis Hulson already said, better, not more, only by size. So here would be, for example, one of these anchor structures. So you would deploy this kind of, this is a prototype, whether it works or not, we will see what we have. You throw this into the ocean, the ROV goes down, pulls a pin, and then this whole thing would just come up, and this would stay as an anchor on the ground. So it's kind of the anchor you would put down. So one thing I want to show you a bit more, because this is the question about the calibration. So ocean, the lines in the ocean swaying, how do you understand the water? So if you want this precision, in the ocean, it is variable. The lines sway in the current. You always need to know where you are. You really need to know this extremely precisely. You also need to understand the optical properties. They do change a bit. You want to monitor this as good as you can, because if you want to go into this extreme precision in terms of energy and pointing, you will not achieve this if you don't have fantastic calibration. So this is actually what we built at, or tried to build in the moment and develop at SFU. So this is this calibration or hybrid calibration module. We don't want to just give up the spots on the line for pure calibration. We want to make it kind of hybrid. So you can see we still have our PMTs here. And then we want to pack all sort of the calibration part on the outside bit. So we have kind of half-half. So we don't give up all the photocathode area on this position. These are kind of light diffusers. There will be lots of different wavelength, extremely intense, extremely short light flashes. What we want to achieve is if you stand, let's say, 3-5 meters away from this, which is, of course, a good approximation for how far these things will be apart, you have a fully isotropic light source. That's what we want to achieve with that. So you see this optical module, which will shine as an isotropical beacon, which then I'll show you in the next slide how we can basically, what we try to do with that. One's for optical understanding and also for calibration of the position. So we'll have some other things. We'll have some cameras. We also self-monitor all this because these things, they could degrade over time. So you need to know always absolutely what's going on with them. It's a lot of effort. Camera, in case of biofouling, everything you could potentially think about. And then on the other side, which is not shown so well, we try, this is the system I want to get rid of, which is the acoustic system, because it's a kind of an extra system you have to integrate, because so far traditionally the positioning is done with acoustic triangulation, yeah? Because it's much easier than anything else. But it's another data stream, it's another complication you have to put in, and also we are exactly in one of the biggest lanes for the US Pacific fleet, so you have with acoustics a little bit of an issue. So we have already the joy of having calls with the NSA and to tell us what we have to implement. But as we're all NATO countries, we actually are friendly, so it's easier, but it's quite interesting. So we were clearly told we cannot take on, for example, Chinese collaborators. It's very clear. So
you have big things like submarines going through that.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
Yeah. And we have to implement low pass filters. So hardware implemented low pass filters that we are not sensitive to low frequency acoustic noises, because that's what's interesting, where you can listen. So yeah. So the point is, I want to get rid of this. So here's an image. What we try to do. This would be an optical line. Now you can see them swaying a little bit. Current going in this direction. Yeah. So this is where my ATLAS site comes in, because I also align the ATLAS in a detector, and you can do this with the same data you use. We in ATLAS, we use events, tracks. We just align with the data we have. So if you could flash here, you detect with all your lines here, you know, you do all these red ones would be kind of, we probably put only two per line, but you can imagine you do this from all the lines respectively. And you can emit, you know exactly precisely the photon pulse you emit, the amount of photons, and also the width of it. Then you can do extremely good optical calibration with these amount of photons, respectively, of course, with all the strings, with the same amount. So you use the same detection mechanism, your PMTs, to calibrate your position as you want to do, take your data with. And you could just, let's say, every 10 minutes, you could just flash for a few, you know, microseconds, and then you can have integrated this in your data processing stream, like a calibration stream, which directly updates, and everything is ready for reconstruction. Would be much easier than doing the left here, which is what we will also implement at the beginning, but hopefully we could get rid of it, is kind of these acoustic pingers. So here would be now, this is an optical module. We would have on each of the hemispheres one of these piezo acoustic elements. If you have two of them, you can get the center position quite precisely. So that you can see this here. So this would be with two of them, what you would get if you receive the signals. And here is, of course, the trilateration, the typical way. So we would have on the seafloor three emitters, which then we would detect on each of the optical modules. And this is traditionally how the point the alignment is done. In these.
Align the detectors, or are you just going to subtract the position with software in the end? Like,
so we need to know the relative position everywhere.
So you can subtract it with software in the end. So if things move, that's what
you're exactly. Doing,
right? You're
not but
going to, like, literally move each little ball.
No, no. These ones will stay where they are, and then you just have to always know relative to each other where they are. But that changes, of course, a lot. So actually, they sway like this a bit in the current. So it goes with one side, and then fascinatingly, also what I teach right now, you know, there are all these forces, fictitious forces, and they actually make this thing sway in a beautiful kind of circular pattern with the tides. Okay, so but it's really, really important. If you want to achieve the precision we aim for, we need to understand this at the best possible level. You cannot ignore this. Otherwise, you don't get this. Okay, I'm going to want to wrap up because despite questions, I'm taking a long time. So this is what we're doing right now. And we really hope to have this in 24. It's extremely aggressive. We are really fast with that. Where are we right now? This is kind of the funding situation. So we try to get this what we call P1 demonstrator, which would be a 10-string unit. So one junction box on the ocean can generally connect 10 strings. That is the goal for now. So we need to demonstrate, if we want to do that, that we can build together with ONC and operate with the quality we want to expect a neutrino telescope, which of course has nothing in comparable size as IceCube. But that is a very decent size. You can see kilometer length on the order of, like, let's say 200, 250 meters in sort of radial displacement. It's a decent size. And only then, afterwards, of course, you can push on. This is the current, I guess, what is sort of highlighted in black, the current funding situation, roughly.
It's 1,000 meters the string?
Yeah.
And you're 2,000 something meters deep?
3,000 almost, yeah.
So it sounds like that's how often does a whale go through there? I mean,
they don't, it's not a problem. And also they can have a good orientation. So nobody's worried about that one.
Or submarines.
Submarines, they would also avoid it. I think also we don't have to worry about tsunamis, but we maybe earthquakes we would have to worry a bit, which is a tectonic plate. So what can we do with that? I'll go through this quite quickly. So just the science goal, if we would get this demonstrator, this is what I meant. Like, we really have to show this, that we can do this. So you have to demonstrate to the community that you can do this. Otherwise, you will not succeed. We need to do all the calibrations. So this would be now, for example, an expectation for one of these optical modules, the coincident level on these little PMTs from potassium-40, for example. So it's quite interesting. You can, with one optical module, you can identify very precisely already atmospheric muons. Because you have a coincident level, you just wait long enough, and every now and then you get very high coincident levels. And even on one optical module, you see already, I mean, you can't reconstruct them, but you can identify the atmospheric muons very, very clearly. But of course, you want to measure this from our expectation, from the Pathfinder missions, that everything is exactly how we do. And then comes the most important thing, we have to demonstrate these capabilities. So here is the pointing part again. Can we really get the pointing we expect? We kind of claim right now, can we get the energy resolution? Can we start to develop the flavor identification, which is really interesting for particle physics? Can we pull out tau neutrinos? You will not get, most likely, but can we do the electron interactions and the muon interactions? You can, a typical thing to understand your pointing is the moon shadow for these kind of cosmic ray experiments, because you have a shadow in cosmic rays. You can, of course, get the shadow also in cosmic rays and then an atmospheric muons. So you usually get this moon shadow, and we should get to this quite quickly with these capabilities, what we have. And you can verify what is claimed right now here. Potentially already, I put back the galactic center. If we really get 10 strings, it's not entirely impossible. As I told you, Antares, so if I compare, I go back to it in a second. So Antares is significantly smaller than a 10-string P1. Antares was only 400 meters high and also smaller. Less photocathode area, way older technology. Of course, they took 8 years of data and they get 2 or 3 sigma if it is real of the galactic center. We are better placed. We will have better technology. I don't want to put that out there as a potential case that we really see something already, but you can at least try. Because it's really skimming where we are, especially with this unique position where we are to observe that. So one could try. But the main part, of course, is then, can we really trigger this array here? So not to be seen if Canada wants to help us build this. We're waiting funding decisions. But of course, Canada will not alone build this. So we have very positive signs from NSF side already. Actually, by now, more Europe and NSF has paid significantly more than Canada in this. So we'll hope that these situations will change, but we'll find out. Okay, so the last thing, I would just want 2 slides, and these are not, I mean, probably if you do neutrinos, you have seen these before. I just want to bring back also, because I'm more the particle physics side. So clearly what these machines try to do now, these detectors, is learn about things we haven't even seen yet. So there's another image. So 25 of the universe, of the most high energetic universe, is actually opaque to photons. You cannot observe. We actually, 25% out there is completely unknown. So neutrinos can do that. So maybe we would see something totally different if we can resolve these sources, things we have no clue about yet. But if we come to this kind of typical, now very popular Venn diagrams, everything you see in there, you probably in all of them, whatever field you are in particle physics, everything of SUSY, leptoquarks, quarks, supersymmetry, long-lived particles, neutrino intersections, sterile, everything is packed in there. So fine. But the point is, all of these things here is the things we try to push. The energy spectrum, so energy resolution, how much can we identify the flavor? Arrival direction, how much we can point. So affects the flavor composition. It's again kind of energy, because we need to identify the tau, the muon, the electron from it. And again, here, arrival times is also the precise timing. So all the things we try to push, so these are the better neutrinos we try to get with such a new detector. So that also gives you, maybe some are more realistic than others. For example, I would say long-range interactions or unusual neutrino oscillations, you know, maybe a TV, PV scale. So that's really, I think, what I'm trying to say, that also the particle physics side is really pushed if we get for this better neutrinos. And I mean, here's just the same here, basically, what you all can get if you would improve your detector components. And of course, the multi-messenger and astrophysical part is clear if you point better. Maybe as a last comment, that's always what I really liked about IceCube. And also, I mean, it's kind of nice in Atlas. It's not a single purpose experiment. IceCube can do so many things. Many things, when IceCube was built, nobody thought you can do atmospheric neutrino oscillations. That came. Now, just shown last week at Morion, the atmospheric angle is currently the most precisely measured by Deep Core. And it's not because it's the most precise experiment, it's by the amount of statistics they see. So nobody thought about that when IceCube was built, that it would be an oscillation precision machine. I looked in my PhD for dark matter from the sun or the galactic center. Like there are so many ways which you can do. So I think it's a nice thing. It's not only a single purpose experiment, these kind of neutrino telescopes. That's why I like them also a lot. So you can combine the particle physics and the astrophysics. And then, okay, I finally stop. There's probably half of us right now in a recent meeting in Vancouver. And I hope I could do only a small propaganda talk, but give you the idea why we want to try to do this here and why I want to do it now. And I think it's a good time. So thank you very much.
Questions?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, one quick question. Could you go a little bit more into detail on the optical properties and the calibration you're doing towards that end? Because I understand that was a pretty big deal for IceCube, measuring the refractive index, the polarizability of the ice. And I'm wondering whether there will be some like time variation of that you're expecting and how that might affect your projected sensitivity.
So yeah, I don't think I really have a plot, so I can stay here. So the medium is, of course, extremely different. So many of the issues IceCube has is the layering of the dust. Then there's something, so I don't know who's speaking, but of course, I think you probably know then quite a bit about it. There's also something they measure, it's called the anisotropy in the ice, which is also not quite clear where it comes from, why a scattering angle is more preferred than another. And it also comes that you basically have very little means to measure this. It's very hard, despite they send dust loggers down and so on, but it's very, very hard. So the IceCube sensitivity, I think they've done a really, really good job. And also this is this IceCube upgrade, which will come in the next X years. It's a low energy upgrade. They throw in a lot of the calibration capabilities. So maybe I can go back to this one. They throw in a lot of the calibration capabilities. They actually throw in, you can't see what I'm pointing to, but on the right side, this integrating sphere, this round blob, the bottom right plot, is actually an IceCube calibration source. So it's called POCAM, what they're going to throw in. And we are taking this POCAM principle and push it essentially further and try to make it even more capable in P1. So there's quite a synergy also to understand between these two things. But then, of course, the optical medium is quite different. So the water is extremely homogeneous, at least on general scales. It might vary a bit. But that's exactly why we want to monitor this all the time in a very, very high precise way. So also these optical emitters, these kind of integrating spheres, so this is just Teflon. So basically, you get these isotropic light. Is exactly, if we can measure the dispersion, we know the precisely measured, it's probably going to be around 1 nanosecond width light pulse of around 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 13 photons. You can measure the dispersion at different distances. If you are capable to do that, you not only can measure the swaying because you know the precision, you can also derive at the optical properties and the refractive index very well. So we have temperature gauges in there, we have pressure gauges, all this affects the refractive index as well. So all these things will be very, very important, but also a bit easier than IceCube. I don't know if this answers your question.
That does, thanks. Do you know from any of the other ocean-based or water-based experiments what you could expect though? Is it actually going to be a homogeneous medium, or do you more expect to actually require like continuous recalibration with these nanosecond light flashes?
So I mean, in terms of positioning, swaying, you have to constantly do that because they move. But in terms of recalibration in the water, I think, I don't know if KM3Net, because Antares is smaller, they have to recalibrate because of essentially degradation in the ocean. Wasn't too bad for them, but they did recalibrate their absolute calibration efficiency. I would say on scales of 100 to 200 meters, this will probably be very homogeneous. I don't know yet, let's say if you take the top 200 and the bottom 200 of the string, if they are identical, but that's something we will be able to figure out with this. And it's also the thing we have to learn with the prototype line, or let's say with the first two, three lines we have.
Right, okay, thanks.
More questions?
What's the price tag?
Price tag?
Yeah.
Cheap. So it's more expensive than KM3Net in the moment per string, but when you put in ship time, recovery time, repair time, putting them back in, it might be worth to pay per string initially a bit more because they actually work to be seen. That's the vision right now, that we actually deploy something that we don't have to recover very often because that's very expensive. In the moment, it's on the order of $1 million Canadian per string. So that is currently. But it will go down if you would get more, for sure.
How many strings total do you want? Like the best you want?
Well, currently the vision is around 70. So not so bad. So 70 to 80. Just to put a price tag on Gen 2, which we aim to have the same capability than Generation 2 IceCube. And I would say it's a very conservative estimate. It's 400 million US. And this would be maybe 100 or so. So it's significantly cheaper.
And you have a huge savings because there's infrastructure on the ocean floor that you're not paying for.
At the moment it is, yeah. So if for full P1, ONC would need an upgrade. But you can see this maybe as a bit of a synergy also how the South Pole Station was built in the first place at all. The synergy of why the South Pole Station is where it is right now is because of the South Pole Telescope and IceCube. So the kind of the science pushed together with the politics, the point to have a larger presence at the South Pole for the US. So you can see it also here. I mean, there are also, so far physics is in ONC, no factor. So that's a new branch of Ocean Networks Canada. That would be a new synergy. And of course, then Canada might also be interested to upgrade ONC to that degree. So that would need, always has to say. So I would say 30 strings around there, I think, is the calculation the current infrastructure could support. But 30 doesn't help. So I mean, you want to go to the, let's say, around cubic kilometer detector. With these capabilities, gives you this factor of 10 in sensitivity. With factor of 10 in sensitivity, you can do real neutrino astronomy and also particle physics at the TeV-PeV scale. So I think it is nice. There's a guaranteed science which is there. We know that from IceCube. Question is now, can
but
we push it to
like
that?
A galactic telescope, I think that's
that would be very, very possible, yes.
So do you have any plots to show us when you compare directly with IceCube, like the error bars or angular?
We don't have sensitivity estimates right now. The reason is simply so we have the angular resolution I showed you before.
Yeah.
I can go back.
Yeah, but the sensitivity, like the error bars, how much flux would you get? Like just to see how much better you can do.
So I don't have a plot for that. The reason is very simple.
Yeah.
I know it's not a good argument. We need to improve on that. We are quite small. And the point is that we know exactly what we have to do. That's the thing. We know exactly what we need to do right now to get where we do. Because in principle, you can take the Ice Cube Gen 2 projections of 10 times more sensitivity and how it would change. Yeah? So if I take these plots, what you've seen, they're just pointing, of course, doesn't work, but just in terms of energy flux, how the error bars would change, yeah? It's exactly the same projections. Yeah? We know exactly what the goal is. Yeah? And in the moment we try to actually build and trim down the detectors to actually make it work. So we know exactly what we need to achieve to do that.
Sorry, but you're aiming at the same error bars on the
It's basically the same, yeah.
And your bidding is going to be much smaller?
Well, in principle, on the energy bins you can do, but that's then just statistics. So, I mean, let's say you can, the uncertainty, I mean, the flux is a convolution, you know, but the certainty of in which energy bin the neutrino would fall would be, well, it depends. I mean, energy is a bit of a, you need to measure it. So I think energy is something where Ice Cube will always be quite good because it's like a colorimeter. The photons just live. You don't need pointing
one last
for that.
Question before we go for lunch. Why did you go for experiment and not detector? Your experiment will be called pond.
Pond. Well, people also call it pony by now. I don't like that at all, you know? But I don't know. I think these things happen generic. Nobody thought about this, what it is, and then it became P1. Actually, what I like more, I don't know, I guess nobody's from Munich here. I'm from Munich originally. The initiators came actually from Munich, and P1 is the nightclub in Munich. And because it's for Prince Regenten Street 1, and I was like, I thought it was the pun why it was chosen, but it was not. Yeah. So that was my thought initially, but don't know why.
Okay.
Well, you can ask me anything, and we can also try to debate the ice. Ice versus scattering versus absorption. Not an easy topic, but I'm happy to try.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go for it.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.